Blog Talk Radio.
Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive because we want to stay alive. In Toret Chaim, instructions of life, Toret Chesed, instructions of kindness, Toret Rachamim, instructions of mercy. You turn into the inner frequency of blogtalkradio.com. We call ourselves Soul Class, and this is Soul Class 507, Secular by Design, Program Presentation Number 44. Blessed is our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha. Blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live at 9:31 Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will focus on reading from a small portion of a seminal work, Secular by Design, a Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, written by Alan W. Cecil. Our call-in number is exactly right now, 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. And you're listening to, in the background, Isaac Batone's Here Comes the Time from the Generation Redemption album. But in order to get on with the shoe, we got to lower the music. Sorry, Reb Isaac. Oh, here we go. There it goes. Bye-bye, music. Okay, and joining us right now is, in fact, the author of this wonderful seminal work, Secular by Design, a Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Don. How are you doing today?
Well, feeling pretty good, and a moment for reflection. But before that, I'm going to call in also Rambam student teacher and disseminator of the teachings of Rambam, Nesher Godel, great eagle, my mind is Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, and every day is a good day. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. How you doing?
Okay. So the moment, good morning, gentlemen, and blessed souls out there. A moment for reflection. Blessed souls, someone pointed out to me the other day, last week to be more exact, that they saw some statistics going back to when abortion was legalized in America. Now, this is a personal choice that anyone makes, but within the greater context of these Sevenoid commandments, there is a prohibition not to murder in a premeditated fashion. And the numbers that were shared with me is that since, I think it was Roe versus Wade in 1973, there have been 52 million abortions practiced legally in the United States of America. That being said, that up until I think the first 40 days, according to Oral Torah standards, that up until the first 40 days, the whatever has developed or whatever has been impregnated inside the woman's womb is not considered to be the level of human being. But I did know today from doing a little research, superficial research, that the heartbeat beats at the beginning or at the end of the fifth week of the fetal development. So I'm just going to share a moment of reflection that for all those 52 billion human beings with all those heartbeats, a little bit of lamentation in a world which is crying out for justice, is crying out for rectification. And in contrast to that, we know that from ancient Roman and Greek society, such children, even if they emerged out of the womb, wouldn't be given much of a chance if they were born with something the world would call a disability or a handicap. So I just want to bring that out as the beginning of this program, Blessed Souls, because there's just not enough, unfortunately, reverence for human life his reverence for animal life and vegetable life and ecological life. And, of course, we do believe in the balance between human beings and the rest of the creation. But I just wanted to throw it as a point of reflection. Alan, would you like to comment on this and the seven high commandments as it relates to abortion?
Yes, I would, Don. Let me look it up. I've got my Rashi out. I'm trying to find something. I think it's in chapter 4 of Bereshis, where it was talking about a man. Back then, a man would often have two wives, one for breeding, one for pleasure, and he would give them herbs or something, the one for pleasure, to abort the baby, so she'd stay young and pretty. And you know, in other words, what's going on here in America isn't a new thing at all, and this is one of the things that the pre-flood generation was condemned for. Just wanted to point that out.
Okay. Dennis?
Yes, when you start treating life as though it's a commodity, you can treat it on the same level as garbage. You discard it when you don't want it. But then again, our Creator created our rules and regulations. And by secular design means that people are willing to accept human thinking as opposed to spiritual thinking that came from our Creator. For instance, thou shalt not kill.
Thank you. And that, let's go right now into the book. We're starting from page 87. Last week we ended the program with my commenting and with some elucidations from Dennis and Alan, Alan and Dennis, about the idea that in American civilization you have elements of Roman law, you have Greek philosophy and law, you have even some smidgen of Torah law, but it's all mixed together. However, from where we're picking up now, there were many elements of Roman law and English common law, which again filtered into American law. Even though where national custom and Roman law came into conflict, national custom prevailed. Selden discusses in detail the triumph of the common law over efforts to establish Roman law as the law of England. And that's quoting from Ziskind's John Selden, Criticism and Affirmation of the Common Law Tradition, page 37. Roman law has had an indelible and lasting impact on English common law, which means at some level it has some effect today in our modern American civilization. However, going back in time, following their expulsion in 1290, there had been no Jews in England, or at least openly, a few Murano refugees. They're also known as the Anusim, the forced ones, because Murano in Spanish means pig, and I don't consider my ancestors to be pigs for leaving Spain because they were being forced into try to adopt a faith which wasn't theirs. A few Murano refugees from Spain probably snuck in here and there into England, but they kept a low profile. For over three centuries, England had been devoid of Jews, which makes Selden's work all the more amazing. Selden, quote, followed through on his long-standing hunch and ancient Jewish that ancient. I'm sorry. Let's read it again. Selden followed through on his long-standing hunch that ancient Jewish society had managed both a thoroughgoing social cohesion and intimacy with the divine will. And that's quoting from Reed Barber's John Selden, printed by Toronto University of Toronto Press, 2003, page 13. His study of Maimonides, here we see another student of Maimonides, led Selden to, quote-unquote, transform the formidably complex Talmud and Mishnah into a finite number of precepts. And that's again quoting from Selden, from Reed Barber's John Selden, page 218, and to champion the seven high laws as the basis for government. And there, Alan quoted Rabbi Isaac Herzog, no one before Selden had so emphatically called attention to the analogy which Jewish law offers in this connection, C-O-N-N-E-X-I-O-N, which I don't know what it means, it means connection with Greek and Roman jurisprudence. And that was printed in John Selden and Jewish Law, Journal of Comparative Legislation International, 3rd Series, Volume 13, Number 4, going back to 1931, page 238. Before I go on to Dennis and Alan, this was, to say at least, a remarkable achievement for someone who had neither met nor seen an Orthodox Jew in his lifetime. For the Jews were not remitted into England until after Selden's death, in 1654. So what I take from this, Alan, is a great form of encouragement, because there he was, so to speak, a lone voice in the desert, calling out for the integration of the Seven Art Commandments into the English society he was a part of. And yet today there's a smorgasbord. So we shouldn't feel, no one should really feel the type of isolation that Selden felt, or probably Selden might have even been in fear of his life if he'd been too open in his promotion of these ideas, because it would have brought him smack face to face with the church in those days. Any comments on this?
Well, he was, he was part of the church. It's just, to me, to have someone in the 17th century come by his use of reason and intellectualism, you know, he came to the conclusion that the Noahide Law should be the basis for a legal system and a government in non-Jewish society. That was a remarkable achievement. But again, you know, he never ceased being a Christian, but this was a product of his reason and his intellect.
Mm-hmm. Dennis?
Yes, well, human constructs exist in government and laws, and we like to call them common, but they're not really common to the source. In other words, they were looking for freedom from the Bible, which is almost like saying, well, we need less of God and more of human parts. But this country is the dichotomy of the example of the East and the West trying to exist when we, not by accident, by purpose, stamped all our money or printed in God we trust. Have we practiced that, or we are now emphasizing the human constructs?
Mm-hmm. Good point, Dennis. And let's go further to page 88 of Secular by Design, in the section called Protocols of the Philosopher. The English jurist John Selden realized, by his own reason and intellect, and here there's a footnote 42, where Alan quoted from Berman, The Origins of Historical Jurisprudence, on Coke, Heldon, and Hale. Selden stressed the importance not only of the covenantal or contractual nature of the Noahide obligations, but also of the God-given human reason in understanding them and a God-given human conscience in fulfilling them, which is very important. Yes, there was a contract, so to speak, a covenant, which was established with the Noahide, the descendants of Noah coming out of that ark over 4,000 years ago. And I guess you can call it contractual. And there was a certain nature of these obligations. But again, there needs to be also human beings activating their reasoning according to what's been laid out before them for the past 4,000 years. And with that being said, that going further into the book, that the Noahide law provided a link between God and non-Jewish society, a divine law that predated Islam, Christianity, and we shouldn't be ashamed to say it, it even predated Judaism. This is not to say, however, that the ancient Jews segregated their society into matters sacred and profane. Nothing could be farther from the truth as Selden sees it. God commanded the Jews to make the institutions of justice. Justice itself was a natural and sacred dispensation. And again, he's quoting, Alan quoted from Barber's John Selden, page 313. So that's a very important point. There is a teaching in the oral Torah tradition where King Solomon talks about this, is that when a Jewish judge sits in a court of law, in a rabbinical court of law, he not only has to be concerned about the case with all the facts being presented to him by the plaintiff and the defendant, he has to be careful that he's not taking bribery, he's not favoring one side, he's not deciding a case which could financially damage another person or even lead to the death penalty of another person, because not only, so to speak, as we say in Yiddish, not only are the kishkas of the plaintiff and defendant on the line, but King Solomon wrote that the judge himself is putting his life on the line if he gets involved in unjust judgment. So therefore, judgment, in according to Judaic Torah teachings, is something just as holy as anything which is a matter of holiness, like saying sanctifying one's name for the sake of God, sanctifying God's name for the, sacrificing one's life, excuse me, for the sake of sanctifying God's name, or extending oneself to help a fellow, a neighbor, and also the commandments of prayer and learning Torah. Justice is just as holy as anything. In fact, we don't say what's holier, but rather we say that all of our actions should be for the sake of heaven. And Selden, it seems, Alan, penetrated that truth that it's not just one day for the church and the other 6 days for secular activity. It seemed that he could see that there wasn't a separation for the Jewish people, and to this day, between, you know, our more formalized, observable religious practices or faith-based practices in prayer and commandments, but also in our daily interaction with human beings, especially at the level of dispensing proper justice. Any comments on that, Alan? I'm commenting.
Yeah.
I'm asking to for the Ben Noach, for how they should see that justice is not a secular matter, but it actually it's applying to Torah law. It's application.
Well, that
in
is
relation
a
to
problem.
Torah.
Yeah, that is still a problem that many Noahites who have come out of organized religion have. They still have this disconnect between, you know, religious and secular, not understanding that from the Torah point of view, there's no division whatsoever. There's, as I pointed out earlier in the first overview, in Judaism, there's no less religious meaning to, you know, selling a piece of furniture than there is reciting a prayer.
True. Dennis?
Yes. All human justice is imperfect. We only hope that the people who do give out justice, mete out justice in any way, shape, or form, follow a spiritual morals and principles, not just human precepts like you mentioned before, but you must have the essence of what is best for everybody, and that's what we trust and believe in.
And, you know, recently, I think in the last year or two, I think maybe, Alan, you remember, because you might remember this better than I, because I think this took place in the South. There was a judge who decided that the Ten Commandments should be placed inside a courthouse. Now, the truth of the matter, it would have been more of an act of justice or to redirect the minds of the plaintiffs that would appear in that court or the defendants in the future that there should be the seven Noahide commandments, because, for instance, the commandment of Shabbat is not directly commanded to the children of Noah. Yet this judge felt he should do something biblical, but really he could have done something more realistically biblical for the plaintiffs and defendants that would have entered his court. Do you remember this case a couple of years ago?
Yes, it was a Alabama judge. And
right.
Although, you know, I understand his reasoning, what he was doing was supporting Christianity. Because, yes, if he had truly understood what the Torah was talking about, he would have put the seven Noahide laws in there, and he would have had a much better argument. What he was doing was emphasizing religion, organized religion, and because of our secular, you know, the separation of church and state according to the Constitution, you couldn't do that. So that's why they had them removed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So really, in his attempt to infuse his own view, he actually fueled the fire for more argumentation and more basically lack of understanding of what the purpose of integrating these teachings into quote-unquote secular courtroom. Continuing on in the book, Selden was not only influential among the 17th century philosophers and scholars, and here there's a lengthy note by Rosenblatt's Renaissance England's chief rabbi, John Selden, page 169. Discussions of Noahide law in the 17th century that referred to Selden respectfully and reverentially appear in the work of Sir Isaac Newton, Henry Burton, an influential Puritan writer, John Lightfoot, Hebraist and master of the St. Catherine's College, Henry Stubb, writer and scholar, Henry Hammond, Jeremy Taylor, James Harrington, political theorist, Edward Stillingfleet, John Tolin, Samuel Pufendorf, Lancelot Addison, father of Joseph, and Sir John Vaughan, among others. It is also clear that Selden's Hebraic scholarship influences Ben Jonson, John Milton, and Thomas Hobbes. Now, that's quite interesting, because I have learned in the past, Alan, that Isaac Newton, in fact, in secret, was an adherent to the seven Noahide commandments. He actually privately rejected Christianity in light of the seven Noahide commandments. But since that he, I think at one time, was the treasurer of the Mint, of the National Mint of England, I believe, that he could not come out publicly because, again, he might have been convicted and even faced the death penalty. But I was very—it's very interesting to see that Selden influenced someone as notable as Isaac Newton. The other people, unfortunately, my own lack of learning of that period, these names are not familiar to. But Isaac Newton, everyone recognized him, that he was doing much more than just letting an apple fall on his head.
Yes, that's true. They were all prominent scholars and intellectuals of the 17th century. And another interesting thing was after John Locke, the English philosopher John Locke, died, they found Selden's book on the Noahide Laws in his library.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So with him being in that context, Selden, throughout his writings, contrasted the severity of the literal text of the Hebrew Bible with the humaneness of rabbinical interpretation of the text and of the rabbinical law. And there, Dennis quoted again from page 179. Dennis, this is a big problem because, again, you know, a lot of people associate the Bible, the Torah as we know it, as an eye for an eye, tooth for the tooth, which, according to the elucidations of the rabbinic oral Torah traditions, has nothing to do with taking a rock and knocking out another guy's tooth because one's tooth was knocked out. So this is probably one of the biggest stumbling blocks that the masses of people have, is that they presented this eye for an eye, tooth for the tooth scenario. It has nothing to do with revenge. It has something to do with, you know, compensation, which is actually integrated and has been entwined very much into compensatory cases in American law. Any comments on that?
Yeah, Judaism really represents a concept of going back to the source and trying to keep the promises or the covenants that were made so that humans don't forget what the source of everything is. But every time we try to get close to the source, there's always a backlash. Just like you mentioned the judge putting in the Ten Commandments in a courtroom. Well, people say that's getting a little too close. Well, you got to get that out of the way. We can't live like that. But every time Jewish people try to remember what our Creator has done and what it represents, a lot of people say, whoa, 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 we're getting too close. We can't do that. So what happens is, it's almost like a human going down to the beach, very close to the water, and then when the tide comes in, you got to fight the tide. It's like nature against humanity. But the source says they're incompatibility. So why think that you're being imposed on when this was the source? To me, I've never understood that. It's just like white people trying to get a tan, and they spend a lot of money getting a tan. But if they get too close to a tan person, they feel very uncomfortable. They think that, oh my God, I shouldn't be near these type of people. It may rub off or something like that. Who knows? But humans are finicky type of people who have to be reminded. And every time someone from the Judaism goes back to remind them, they're resentful. This is the basis for some hatred and crazy human thinking, but it still persists.
True. But that's something that we as Jews have to bear in mind, and we have to have a lot of patience, first with ourselves, that, you know, just because we appear on the scene, that doesn't mean people should bow down to our thought process, because we're basically here to engage people, to engage their own thought process, to activate their own, otherwise, you know, for the most part, healthy human intellect, to try to see how their previous education, or I would say diseducation, has caused them to misperceive these Torah teachings, and how actually they're much more accessible than anyone ever taught them. But I just want to, we're getting close to the end of the program, gentlemen and blessed souls out there, so I want to read a little bit further. And as Alan mentioned, excuse me, before, one of the many admirers of John Selden was the British philosopher John Locke, whose writings on natural law and liberty influenced later 18th century American intellectuals such as Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence. So we see, again, there was a little bit of a filtration at some level of what Selden had so much toiled on that actually made into somehow the head of Thomas Jefferson, which I'm sure if someone were to put the Declaration of Independence or other letters written by Jefferson, that you'd probably see something of the influence of Selden there. Soon, however, the legal concepts from the Torah were replaced by subtle shift in ideas and language among Western intellectuals. And this is where it became a little tricky, and this is where the discussion continues until this day. Natural law became natural rights, or inalienable rights, and the light of Torah that Selden and Grotius ignited among the Christians flickered only too briefly before it was extinguished. The intellectuals of Europe backslid into the anti-Semitic Greco-Roman philosophies that so enamored the Enlightenment philosophers such as Voltaire. Excuse me. And we're quoting from Herzog, the French Enlightenment, the Jews, page 30, the crucial turn in the 1670s, where the debate between the Bible and the Jews, both ancient and modern, was essentially secularized. So again, it was taken out of its original context and over-intellectualized, which gave power to such people as Voltaire, yet faint traces of philo-Semitism from Selden's work survived, for it was during the decade of the 1630s when Selden wrote his most important works on the Noahide laws that waves of Puritan immigration from England floundered onto the shores of North America, primarily to Canada, the Caribbean, and New England, where over 20,000 Puritans immigrated during this short but influential time. By the 1640s, during the English Revolution, the Puritan victory was that meant they no longer need to flee Britain, and the influx, the arrival of Puritans to America, gradually slowed to a trickle, as the intellectual ideas of the Enlightenment swept across Western Europe, where the ideas of Selden were ridiculed and then ignored. The Christian Hebraists who had been influenced by Selden had found a safe haven in America. And turning to footnote 47 in my last reading of today's presentation from Hofstadter's Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, page 60 to 61, these Puritan immigrants, with their reliance upon the book, the Bible, and their wealth of scholarly leadership, founded the intellectual and scholarly tradition which for three centuries enabled New England to lead the country in education scholarly achievement. Puritanism, as a religion of the book, placed a strong emphasis upon interpretation and rational discourse and eschewed rational emotionalism. So, at the same time, too, Alan, but there was also, you know, there were elements within the Puritan movement where they were extremely judgmental, where, you know, for witch trials, where they would put a person on a, I guess, something like a diving board and immerse them in the water. And if they came up alive, then they were a witch and then were burned at the stake. And if they had drowned, that was proof they weren't a witch. So, you know, where was this shift where the Puritans seemed to be taking something from Selden's influence and then they went off the track? Are you aware of what happened, that what undermined Selden's influence on the Puritans?
Well, the first thing is Christianity. They were still Christians, but without... The thing with the Christians is they did approach it rationally. They looked at the laws of the Torah being legal in nature. You know, they weren't the, you know, Jesus did away with all that stuff. They looked at the entire Torah as being binding. Because they didn't really have any sort of intellectual leadership or the kind of knowledge that Selden had, they, of course, went to extremes. And like you pointed out with the witches, did the Guantanamo thing with them.
Waterboarding.
Yeah, we're still doing it today, as a matter of fact. But, you know, it's just, that's one of the reasons the United States has been, I mean, in the eyes of Europe, is such a much more religious-minded country.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, you've been to Europe several times, I know. In fact, you were there a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, whatever. Your take on the movement to America and the opportunity for change, but yet still being stuck in the old rut.
Well, that's the nature of mankind, is that we don't really improve, but we like to repeat. So we're always looking for a safe haven somewhere. to get away from what? The truth? Pure justice? Real life? Whatever. What happens is we're all wandering around thinking that we're going to find a place where we're going to get peace. There is no real peace on earth because that's what heaven represents. So we try to do our best, but we are imperfect. And we end up, let's say, justice. I mean, who gave out better justice than King Solomon when he told the two mothers, oh, that case will split the baby? A lot of people don't learn from that, and there's a lot of wisdom in that. And the other thing that we have that the colonists brought over, and they thought it was a good idea, and they never practiced it, and that is there's no such thing as pure justice on earth. It's only in heaven, and God is the creator, the real judge. However, there are people that say, don't judge anybody else by standards that wouldn't apply to you. And that is something a lot of humans don't understand. They believe that they can give out justice to other people, but they're immune because they're giving out the justice. Well, that's the wrong concept of justice. It's for all, not for selections, not for this or that. And every time Jewish people come and try to remind people, it was never set up that way, and it was never intended that way as what you're applying. So therefore, you don't understand, so you need direction. And that's what Alan just mentioned. When the original colonists came over, there was no real intellectual direction or management of anything. So you leave humans alone to do things by themselves, and you'll find out a lot of extremes that exist in human nature.
True. And in terms of, all nations have been in a rut. We also, the nation of Israel, have been in a rut. That's why we see at the beginning of the book of Isaiah the sharp rebuke that Isaiah apportions out to the nation of Israel for not meditating and the injustices they had been engaged in at that time and how they can rectify those injustices. So this is a nation-to-nation matter. Within each nation, how each nation relates to another nation, whether historically or presently. And I would just say that it would help us to reconsider that things can change, but we'll be segueing out with our segueing ending musical presentation by David Thum in the now. But before we do that, I'd like to just turn quickly to Alan and Dennis. Any last nuggets of wisdom, gentlemen, you'd like to share our audience before we conclude today's program? Alan?
Yes, Bereshis, or Genesis 4:19, that's the verse, and I suggest people read Rashi's commentary to that verse. That's what we were talking about at the beginning of the program.
Okay, thank you very much. That's about how a man would keep one wife for pleasure and another for childbearing. I see that men have been for a long time what did the feminists call them? Male chauvinist pigs? It's been going on for a while. Dennis, any concluding remarks?
Yes, and that is that if you think you read the Bible, you should read it again because there's stuff in there that you missed. You don't realize. But you took what was first impression, even second impression. But if you go back and read the Bible again, you will find something that will help you in your life.
That's a wonderful piece of wisdom to share with our blessed listening audience, Dennis. And we're going to end off now with In and Out by David Thum. Will help us get back home, to help us realize our Tzelem Elohim is no dream. Our divine image will help us get off in scrimmage. And blessed souls, we've got to do good because Hatev Hatev Lehitiv. It is the nature of the good to do good, and the source of all goodness is in the Creator. So if we try to make that courageous decision to do things in the now, yes, we might have made mistakes in the past, that's okay. We're not perfect. The Torah is not here to make us perfect, but to rectify and to strengthen our efforts to make this world manifest as to be a place of Ahavachad, one love, Gorlachad, one destiny, Kulam for all of us, Badarchi Noam, Darchi Shalom, in a pleasant way, in a peaceful way, Laham Shich, to be continued as Bezer Hashem Yisprek, to continue with the help of the Most High, and hopefully at this time next week we'll be reuniting with Alan and Dennis. Dennis and Alan, my name is Danzo Sigubin, your Torah activist here out in cyberspace. And here we go with David Dome. Let's get back home.
It don't matter to me where you've been. The people you knew and the places you've seen. If you've been hungry and you've broken a heart, we all have our very own place to start. There ain't no one who hasn't done anything wrong. Now's your chance to make it all turn out just right. Or will you put up a fight? One in the sun and the one in the shade. The contrast is as clear as black on white. I've seen better in the light. Don't cling on to all your past misdemeanors. The past is done, what matters is where you are. Anything wrong, and now's your chance to make it all turn out just right. Or will you put up a fight? I'm always thinking, will you put up a fight? I'm always thinking, you can correct the wrongs and make them right. All of your pain gets removed out of sight. If you keep looking to the past, any love found may never last. Live in the now, that's what to do. Those mistakes were made to make a better you.